I was asked to choose a topic that would be covering for all the other sessions during the week. And so I chose a walk through pre-Columbian cultures. I should probably have said selected pre-Columbian cultures, because that's what I did. I selected them. And I don't know how familiar you are with particular terms that relate to that topic, but I think if we go around the room here and introduce ourselves, maybe we'll find out a few things. And if you would tell us what your occupation is, where you're from, and a special interest of yours, and then your name. Your name last, because we'll remember that better if it comes last. And I'll start. I'm a retired teacher, English teacher, and I live in Strawberry Point, Iowa. And I have always been interested in the pre-Columbian cultures and read about them like some children do, dinosaurs, and then eventually traveled through the areas where those civilizations flourished. And my name is Alpha Evans.
I work as a public health nurse, and I'm from Cooperstown, New York. And interests, like, I enjoy reading, and I like doing outdoor things like hiking and swimming. My name is Nancy.
Nancy.
I'm also from Cooperstown, New York. And I'm an emergency physician, and we just saw some of the ruins in the Southwest, which I don't think would qualify as, well, I'm not sure. Pre-Columbian, meaning when Columbus came to America?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, I guess that would be...
They qualify.
It would be pre-Columbian. Yeah, and that was kind of interesting.
Now, where were the ruins? At the Chaco Canyon?
Yeah, in the Four Corners area. Four Corners is... Well, the four states come together, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. And that's where a lot of those ruins are. My name is Jake.
I'm a nurse, and I work in physical medicine at the University of Michigan Hospital. I live in Michigan. Most of my life I've lived in Michigan. About 10 years I lived in Puerto Rico. And when I saw Columbian, I thought it referred to the South American. But then I see Mesoamerican.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know much more about this than what I picked up in high school, I'm afraid. And I don't know if I remember much of that. My name is Evelyn.
Okay, I'm Polish. My roots are Midwest, but I grew up in Arizona and then transferred to the Northwest in the 70s. And ever since, I have my interest lies in anything that has to do with people, culture, and societies. I'm drawn.
I'm retired recently from a church secretary position. And I live in Round Rock, Texas, which is just right outside of Austin. I have never moved in my life, so I've still been on the same place that my grandparents called in 1870. And my interests, you know, it's not anything really special, just people. And God's creation really is what I like. This is what I enjoy. And my name is Grace.
And I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm a retired civil engineer. I like hiking and geology. And my wife's a Spanish teacher, and we spent a lot of time in Mexico. And we climbed up and down a number of these ruins that I'm hoping we'll see again this next week when you're here. My name's Roger.
I'm a retired educator, and I live here at Holden. I haven't spent any time in the areas covered by your talks. So I'm very interested in learning more about those. And my name's Carl.
I'm also from Round Rock, Texas, Central Texas. One grew up in that area. I worked for years as a public health nurse also. Austin Travis County Health Department is now Health and Human Services. and I direct their maternal and child health programs now. And I'm very interested in this. As a matter of fact, just missed an opportunity about 2 weeks ago to see the pre-Columbian art exhibit. It was in the San Antonio Hemisphere.
Oh, that's too bad that you missed that. It was supposed to be spectacular.
We were going down and then couldn't for some reason, so I just missed that.
And you?
Well, I'm on the staff in the biblical area. I'm from Tacoma, Washington, where I'm recently retired from PLU. So in the biblical area. Happy to be here.
And your name?
Ralph.
Excuse me, you said that in the beginning.
Huh?
We'd like to know
what
your occupation is, where you're from, if you have special interests, and what your name is.
Okay, I'm Martha. From Litchfield Park, Arizona. I'm a retired cost analyst from the aerospace industry, and I am currently selling a product. And I'm here as a way try, and I've been here 4 weeks, and I will be here.
Okay. Well, I want to call your attention particularly to the word walk up here. There's so much to tell about the pre-Columbian cultures that when you have a limited time to do it in, that's about all you can do is take a walk through them. And I use that term because I wanted you to understand that what we will be doing is an overview of things in the hope that something will catch your attention and that will intrigue you enough so that you will either read about whatever it is that interested you or make an effort to go and see it. The other term, pre-Columbian, many of us would love to get rid of that. And I was interested in the comment of a busmate on Sunday afternoon when he mentioned what I was going to do, and he said, "Can't we get rid of Columbus?" And it's such an ingrained term, you see, that we have, that it will probably always be there. Because it's handy. It places a name on a time barrier. But for me, I've always thought of Columbus as being an invader, that he invaded the continent and rather than that he discovered it. Many people from this area resent that term, discover, too, because they like to think that it was always there, and they don't think about discover as meaning someone finds out for the first time. They think about it as meaning that it wasn't there until he saw it. But there are really two definitions of pre-Columbian. Mm-hmm. The common one is to use that term to refer to the civilization that flourished during what we call the classic times, which would be the years 200 AD through 900 AD. Then there's a bigger one, which is literal, and would mean that it would be all the human beings with cultures who inhabited the area before the time of Columbus. Then a culture, I'm sure you're all aware of what a culture is, but let's just run through it. Archaeologists have an interesting definition for culture. They say it's the sum total of the way of life of a group of human beings. That's interesting. Wonder what we should do. I don't know.
I think it's some of the
but always when something like that happens, you need to go and see.
Oh, it's that's like for special going
for certain ones that are leaving.
All right. Good journey, mate.
Well, goodbye, people. So, back to culture, which is all the things about a people that make it unique. It would include their beliefs, their customs, their traditions. It would include their ideas, everything that makes them unique, and which has been built up over time and passed from one generation to another. So that's the breadth of the word culture that we're speaking of here. And then Mesoamerica, that's a coined word. And everybody was delighted when that word was coined, because previous to the coining of that word, they would have to say southern Mexico, Yucatan Peninsula, Guatemala, Belize, and western Honduras. So an anthropologist decided that was enough of that monkey business. He had had it with that, and he coined the word Mesoamerica to cover that area in which those civilizations rose and flourished before the time of Columbus. Then look down at the session topic for today, which includes the word roots. That's a terribly overworked metaphor, but it's so very handy. When you pull up a plant and you shake off the earth and you see the structure of the roots, the tap root, and then all the tiny little tendrils that feed off in every direction, it seems to be a very appropriate metaphor for the building of a civilization or the building of anything, because many little things feed into the main channel. And so we use that term, probably overuse it. And what we're going to try to do today is to go back and see what the ancestry was of those people who eventually, in this country, in this hemisphere, established civilizations, which were awesome, even to the Europeans who first saw them. In fact, it has been established that everything that the old world had going on, the new world had going on too, and in almost parallel times. It's simply that they were separated, and so they were not aware of what was going on. So we're going to go chasing clear back to Pleistocene times to try to find the things about these early people which fed into a single channel which eventually produced the magnificent civilizations that some of you have seen. Now, you said that you had traveled where?
In Guatemala, in Tikal, I said.
Yeah.
Yes.
Towering things that when you climb one of the temples and you look out over it, all you see is green jungle and these white roof cones sticking up. And then you walk their cities and you realize how very complex their society was. Somebody else had been you.
Yeah, we saw, you know, like the pyramid, sun and pyramid.
Did you go climbing way up?
Oh, you bet.
It's exciting to see it and to imagine that thing peopled as we know it was at one time, with everything going on, markets and the hierarchy of society, and but you never visit those places that there isn't this thought that goes through your mind. I wonder how this all happened and what were the traits passed down from generation to generation, from the very first Americans, which led up to...
How far north does Mesoamerica extend?
About midway in Mexico. Have you been to Teotihuacan?
I've never been to Mexico.
You must go to Mexico. It's wonderful. About 150, 200 miles up. It's central, about central. It cuts off. I was going to bring a map of Mexico, and I thought I had it, but I don't. It's just about halfway up. And it would include the civilizations which had their centers at Teotihuacan, which is north of Mexico City, Tula, which is also north, El Tajín, which is on the coast. See, so it just goes about halfway up. And then it takes all of the Yucatan Peninsula and all of Belize, which of course used to be British Honduras, all of Guatemala, and then just a little slice of western Honduras. Well, always when I have been in one of these places and wandered through the cities, and many times have gone back a second season, I wondered about the people, who they were and who they really were, where they came from, how they got here, when they got here, and why they came. And we're going to work with those questions. Who were these people that came into North America or became citizens of North America, so to speak, Who were they? Well, archaeologists tell us that they had to be immigrants. Many of the Maya people don't like that. They like to think that they originated right in that spot, that they originated in that hemisphere. But there have not been any remains of ancient man, even the latest Neanderthal man found in the Western Hemisphere. So archaeologists and anthropologists say these people were immigrants. And then where did they come from? Most logical place was, of course, Siberia in Asia. And not just because it's a logical place, but because there are racial characteristics which the indigenous Native Americans had that also were found in the Asians. And not too long ago, I read in Archaeology magazine that they had found tools in a certain section of Siberia which almost exactly matched some that had been found in North America. That is, the chipping and the style of the tool were almost the same, which they considered to be still another bit of support for the origin of these people. Then there are lots of theories as to how they got here. Probably the commonest one being that they crossed on a land bridge. If you go back to the Pleistocene period, to the waning years of the Pleistocene, which would be, and you have to remember that these years are kind of fluid, but they pretty much are solid from 80,000 years BC up to about 9,000 BC. They consider that the waning years of the Pleistocene, when there was an advance and retreat of glaciers periodically. And then with the advance of one of the glaciers, a big advance, so much water was drawn up into the ice masses that it exposed this land bridge. In fact, the levels of the oceans dropped 300 feet. And so this land bridge would have provided a route for them to use. And it was 1,000 miles wide and 55 miles long, that land bridge. Then they always said, well, what would they do with all this ice? Some of it was 4 miles thick. The ice seemed to be collected into two great glaciers, the Cordilleran, which came down the western part of North America, and the Laurentide, which came down through Canada and into the eastern part. And that left a corridor in the middle. Now, the conditions would have been very, very bad for life. It was tundra-like and very cold, but it was an avenue through which they could come. Then there are some that hold they came by boat. There wasn't any reason they couldn't have come by boat anytime they wanted to, because they had skins, and they could have made skin boats and made that crossing without crossing on the land bridge. And then there are some that say that they just came over by boat and then just drifted down the Pacific coast a little bit at a time and followed it down. So there's pretty much a consensus on who these people were, immigrants from Asia, and how they got here. Now, it could have been all three of those ways that they got here. Whatever it is, they got here. Now, when did they come? There's just all kinds of discussion about when the first Americans really arrived in the Western Hemisphere. And of course, there are those that say, what difference does it make? But it is a puzzling question, and more answers are being found to when they came. There have been recent discoveries in the Yukon in Alaska, and I think those go back to 26,000 to 29,000 BC. They have dated bone tools in a tool cache up there that date back that far. in the Yukon in Alaska. Then going down, farther down in the continent, in Puebla, Mexico, they have also found cultural remains of human beings in association with remains of ancient animals, mastodon, mammoth, and dire wolf. They found those in association with one another. So that time that the first Americans came as being pushed back and back and back. They used to think that they didn't get here until 10,000 BC, but that has, it's all changing. What we do know, and archaeologists have some pretty solid evidence to make this prediction on, is that by the year 9,500, that people could be found in every part of North America and South America. They found evidences of human occupation that date to that date all over. So they had traveled that whole distance. However they got here and however they proceeded and however fast they went, by that time, period of time, they had made their way from one end of the Western Hemisphere to the other. Now the remaining question is why did they come? And that's just speculation. And so I think it would be fun for you to decide how you think, why you think they came. What would have motivated people to make that perilous journey? What social or environmental things would have caused them to move across that particular area or by boat into a very forbidding land? What technical skills would they have had to survive? What social skills would they have had to survive? So why don't you four people here put your heads together and think, why do you think they came? See, what motivated them? And you four do the same thing, and you three do the same thing back there, and then we'll see what you all think. Now, I thought I had some paper here, but I don't seem to be very well provisioned, so. I'll put the questions up here. Run up and get you some pieces of paper. So you can remember what you're saying, or you want to write it down? Good. What a good class.
Of that age, and one of the big debates is, was it overkill by these paleo hunters?
Or whether it was the climate.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Following the big game.
Okay. Did you come up with any? Let's take everybody's whys, and then we'll go around the other way. What was your thought?
We thought of social pressures, warring tribes,
surely a possibility.
Better tax situation.
Right.
Well, okay. I wrote one down that they haven't mentioned. A vision for something better.
Yeah. Oh.
A desire for something in addition to what they have.
To seek a better life, right?
We've come a long way, haven't we?
Isn't that a common cause, though, for moving? When you think of your own, we're all immigrants. Do we have any Native Americans here? Our people were all immigrants. You just think back, what motivated them? I've always blamed my habit of my work ethic on my great-great-great-grandfather, who came to the United States as an indentured servant and worked 7 years for his passage. So you see, those genes, you just travel right down the line.
I said that to my father about my grandfather, who came 100 years ago, and my father said, "You're way wrong." He said, "Not only did they have the money in gold to buy, they weren't poor, the land in Wisconsin, but the main thing was simply because My grandfather's children from the first marriage had come to the United States, and they wrote such glowing reports. So it wasn't particularly that they had to, but my grandfather's first wife died, and people from that family came over first. So then the new family, my grandmother was much younger than my grandfather, they came. So my father said, that doesn't work, at least.
But now our forebears wouldn't have come for this, of course, but some of them came because they were hungry. That was a motivation for immigration on the people of today. Basic needs is what we're talking about. Basic needs. Certainly this could have been, all of these could have been the reasons why. What technical skills would they have had to have?
We had another one back.
Oh, wonderful.
In that we thought possibly a natural disaster of some sort, either, you know, physical or like a fire or whatever. And then just pure adventures.
I didn't get the last?
Pure just adventuresome.
Adventure. Okay.
Yeah, the natural disaster, we know there was a big meteorite that burned lots of forests and stuff, a Tunguska meteorite. Now that's reported historically. But there are all kinds of hidden meteorite impact craters in different places, like in Siberia. So could there have been a humongous one, you know, that really scared the people, burned forests and whatnot, and sent them on their way? Mm-hmm.
Just got them started.
Yeah,
just got them started. Yeah, certainly a possibility. Now, what technical skill? Excuse me.
They could probably get pushed by the climate change too.
That's right.
Overpopulation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or just following the herds.
Following the herds. Technical skills.
Well, they wouldn't have needed probably anything much greater than what they already had. They were in a northern climate, in a very difficult climate anyway, and I would think they were coming into a better climate, coming down the Western American continent coast with the Gulf Stream there. I think the climate's going to be warmer moving down there than it was where they were before. So.
You think they could just bring the toolkit they had?
Yeah.
Okay.
They'd have to be hunters.
Right. Have to be hunters. Back here?
They must have traveled, if you're right, quite fast, because, boy, going through Canada is pretty bleak.
Yeah. they just moved. They were following game, so it would depend on how fast the game moved. But when you read about this, it seemed the progress was slow. The progress was slow.
I was going to say that when you say progress was slow, it's relative. Was it like generations, or was it just a matter of 15, 20 years? Mm-hmm. Or was it like one generation, then the next generation a little further south? Was it like over 100 spears?
They track that through the types of tools that they find and the carbon-14 dating that they can get on them. But the everything you read says that the travel was slow. And you understand that it took place over thousands of years.
That's what I meant by slow. What's slow?
What's slow? That's a very relative term. I realize that. Social skills, what would they have had to have? Anyone?
They needed a leader.
They would need a leader.
Work together as a group.
Yeah, they would have to know how to work together as a group. Many of them were just family groups of the nomadic people.
They would have had to have certain values that they shared, certain master stories that would make sense to them.
Right. Certain beliefs they would have had to. They identified very closely with natural things, too. Now,
excuse me, I think we have to put in here what the Latter-day Saints also have as an explanation for how people got here. Now, maybe not the hunter-gatherers, maybe not bring it up for the later ones. But I mean, to me, of course, it's fairly off the wall. I mean, that the ancestors...
Well, let's hear it. It's nice to go off the wall.
Well, the LDS view is that they came in some kind of a submarine, and these are the lost tribes. And how do you explain these great civilizations, the Maya and so on?
I don't know that they're really dealing with hunter-gatherers, but that they came over there, some of the scattered lost tribes.
In a submarine?
Well, yeah, some kind of a submarine. Yeah, I mean, I have a special on archaeology as a guest of an LDS person. They have beautiful slides of the area, but then they go into this theory.
Yeah.
And you can, you know. Something. So, I mean, that's another view that you do run across, which is...
Yeah. Well, what they do tell us, and they know this from the analysis of tools that are found, that these were very simple people. They had very simple tools. They were made by flint knapping, chipping, and the earliest tools were stone, and they were made just from pebbles, and there was no sophistication at all in the weaponry that they had. So we know that they were very simple people, and also that they had simple needs in order to survive. Now, along about 9,500 things, caches of tools, and sometimes they call them toolkits of the early hunters, they began to show a difference. They began to show some sophistication in the type of tool. They were bifacially faced. In other words, they were chipped on both sides. They had a certain kind of base that would provided a ridge for them to put the shaft of either the dart that was thrown by an atlatl, which is a kind of a do you know what an atlatl is?
Yeah, it's propelled, okay. propelled spear.
And that would hold that. They'd wrap it with thong around that. So they could see that this tool is showing a sophistication that the others hadn't shown. And of course, that is the Clovis point. And I'm sure that's a familiar term. How many of you know about the Clovis projectiles? Well, we don't know, all of us. Well, they were the first points were found in Clovis, New Mexico. And that's why they called them that. And they date between 9,000 and 10,000 BC using a very sophisticated carbon-14 dating process. They know that. Now, the latest discovery of Clovis tools took place in 1987, right over here in East Wenatchee, Washington. When I came out, I came a day earlier, thinking that I could get over to that orchard and see this place. Well, I got over to the orchard, but there was nothing going on. They were digging an irrigation ditch over there in 1987, and the workmen turned up some of these projectile points. And they knew they had something. It wasn't just a little chunk of rock. And so they took it to the owners of the orchard, and the owners of the orchard called in an archaeologist. And he said, "You have a Clovis point here." And it was unusual in that most of these points are fairly small. They don't ever get more than 4 to 6 inches. And the ones they found over there were nine inches, big ones. Now, if you go over there to the museum, they have a very wonderful display, but none of the points that are there are the ones that were found. They're facsimiles, because the ones that were found went back to Boston with the man who did the last excavation, and he is doing some checking with other archaeologists about them. But when I visited the museum in East Wenatchee, they gave me the Pleistocene times, and I have one for each of you. And if you open it to the middle fold, just pass them down, you'll find the picture of the representation of the Clovis point. I told them what I was going to do, and they said, "Oh, take enough for everyone." In addition to the Clovis points, they also found some bone tools, long bone tools, and they don't know what those were used for. Do you have a knife? On that center pole, there also is a very nice mapping of the glaciers and the possible route of the immigrants. Now, look at the, do you have it open to the middle, all of you? Do you see the two points that are over there on the left-hand side of the right exposure there? If you look closely at the base, which is the bottom there, you'll see that center flake out of there, which provided the ridge for them to place the shaft against, and then to wind the thong around it. I think you'll find this an interesting paper. If you flip now to the very front of it, it has a nice, also a very good representation of the fact that the game also traveled across that land bridge. So you had the people and the animals going back and forth. I'm going to give you something else here, and you can take that home and you can read that at your leisure. This is a chronological table, and it kind of helps you get a fix sometimes. You can talk years, but sometimes that is hard to visualize. Now you notice it says chronological table there. That's because I couldn't get that on the copier at home. There's supposed to be a C on there, people. And then at the end of that line to the left, there's supposed to be a 20,000. Supposed to be a 20,000. Now this isn't a true timeline, because the segments are not the same. They don't represent the same number of years, but they were limited in the space. What I would like you to notice is the term lithic over there on the upper left. That, of course, means stone. And we're talking about Stone Age there. And you will find Clovis in there for North America. Notice, too, that as we move farther to the right, we have another advance in the production of tools. They become even more sophisticated under the Falsen, the Falsen points. And those are named also after the place where they were first found. One thing that always strikes you when you look at something like this is how empty North America is. Look down there, see how empty it is? Then look at Mesoamerica and South America. Can you think of a reason why things seem to be going along there in North America and they're still hunting and gathering, and we've got the woodland Indians, and down here in Mesoamerica we've got civilizations developing?
Climate. The climate was better?
It could have been. Climate could have been better. But we've got wonderful climate in North America, too, up in the United States.
Yeah, and the glaciers were there, though.
Okay. Well, they eventually receded along about 7,000 BC. It's related to the game situation. You see, game was still plentiful in North America, and it became less plentiful down in what became almost desert-like region. And so those people had to do something else. They could not anymore survive just on going out to find little plants to eat and going out to hunt animals. They decided that maybe if they planted some of those seeds, they wouldn't have to go so far to get the production. And so you had the beginning of agriculture. And it's the beginning of agriculture that lies at the root of those magnificent civilizations.
Would that be at in Mesoamerica especially?
Mm-hmm, that's right. You see where it says maize in use by 5000 BC?
That's yeah. Right.
So those people that study the rise of those civilizations tell us that the production of maize, domesticated maize, and squash and beans, that single thing is responsible for the rise of those civilizations. That unless people have to live a settled life, they never develop leisure time. And when there is leisure time, you have time to become specialists in things, which they did. They became specialists in art, they became specialists in government, specialists in their religious doctrine. So a whole area of specialization began with the development of agriculture. And that, there was this transition about the year 7000. If you find 7000 and run it clear down, you'll find the term archaic. Now those are names for cultural eras. And the cultural eras have different names in different parts of the country. In North America, the cultural eras are the woodland tradition and so on. You get down into Mesoamerica and you have archaic, formative, classic. You get down into South America and you have initial periods and horizons, so on. So they have different names, but they cover the same periods of time. Now somebody mentioned the climate over here. The Indians that survived did have to make adaptations to climate. And that was a factor in their survival and the eventual development of their civilization. Now, they find the archaic area on the bar that comes down in Mesoamerica, and then find it up above where it says Pan America, and you'll see that those coincide there. And they should come right along the year 7000. Now your people are not hunters and gatherers. They are settling down and they're beginning to raise crops. They also are raising dogs to eat. I think dogs are still eaten in some parts of Mesoamerica. As the archaic period goes along, the culture develops more sophisticated ways of dealing with things. They have begun to make baskets. They are more sophisticated in their making of pottery. They're making mats. Their houses and the house foundations that are found, they can tell that they're made from wattle and daub. They're no longer skins and poles and things like that. So they had many ways of, there are many evidences of the gradual progress toward a more sophisticated society. Now if you'll follow that archaic bar down in Mesoamerica, over to the place where it says early formative, and then just drop down and you'll see that the Olmec civilization, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, and I have traveled in that area and have some slides to show you of the artifacts of the Olmec civilization. We're feeding from the archaic period right into the Olmec civilization, which is the first of the really complex civilizations to emerge. And they developed many skills, which they fed into the other civilizations that grew in Mesoamerica. So, in summary here, what traits of those people do you think fed into these civilizations? What personal traits could we consider these people who may have come for game or because of social pressure to seek a better life or because of a natural disaster? They were people and they had personal traits. down the line, from generation to generation. If you're a teacher, you know sometimes you have parents come in and you talk to them about Mary and so on, and they say, well, that's just like Uncle Ned. He couldn't do that either. So we tend to think about inherited traits. Now, you're going way back thousands of years, but generation after generation after generation, there must have been a few little genes in there that came sneaking along from generation to generation, up to and including these magnificent people who built these civilizations. Can you think of some personal traits?
Persistence.
What? Persistence, probably. Persistence.
Adaptability.
Adaptability, right.
Ambition of a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. Ambition, the wanting always a better life. And isn't that a common human desire for us to have that wish for our own children who are coming after us, that they would have a better life? And who's to say that these people didn't have that generation after generation as the years went by? Can you think of anything else?
Prolific?
Beg pardon?
Prolific?
They were prolific? In what are we thinking of?
Well, they expanded the population.
Expanded the population? All right. Do you think they must have had some beliefs that carried them along? Mm-hmm. Basic beliefs. And that is so interesting, because we tend to forget that these people had basic beliefs that carried them along just like we have. And their beliefs may take a different direction. But it's interesting when you read about these people and you study the different, and I'm talking now when I say these people about the people whose civilizations developed from these early roots. They have these different hierarchies of gods, and they have 9 levels of the underworld and 13 of the heavens and the flat world with 4 corners and all of these things. But when you get to certain levels of their religion, it feeds into one. The belief in a one supreme thing. You see, we got the God of the sun, the God of the moon, the God of the rain, and all this, but it feeds into one thing. So they must have had basic beliefs that carried them along. Very primitive instruments that they used to do their sighting. They just sighted along lines. When you travel through these ruins, you find places that are probably observatories, where all they had was the eye that you just sighted over.
I think all of their physical senses were far more acute than repetitive. We've lost, I think, a lot of that.
So yeah, we have so much impacting our...
Well, it's not necessary. It was just not. Mm-hmm. So, I think it must have been very acute physical senses.
Well, it's been real fun to have you here, and I hope you have fun meeting the plastic scene.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is this pen here?